Hey friends, just a quick note to say how much we appreciate any donations to Health Freedom for Humanity. We pride ourselves on being low overhead, so any money you donate goes directly to the very things that are active in the fight for freedom. Things like the website, administrative costs, and small salaries for those that are coordinating the work. In the future, we look forward to setting up local chapters in each state and being more activist-driven while still giving you the content you need to stay informed. Simply go to healthfreedomforhumanity.org/donate and give to your heart's content. Thank you so much for your participation.
Everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Health Freedom for Humanity podcast. This episode we had as our guest, Dr. Larry Pilevsky. Fellas, I thought that was phenomenal. I mean, every episode that we've had has been phenomenal in their own right. It's just like how we record our intros after having done the podcast. It's always, I sound like overly pumped up because I am. Like underneath my sweatshirt, I'm sweating pretty bad because I was just so excited the entire time.
I just wish we had more time because that hour went by so fast, Alec, Tommy. That went by like in 15 minutes, I felt like.
I know. And now I feel like the way we are just as this triad, we draw out parts of these knowledgeable, like crazy smart masters of their craft, which can be so from Callan to Northrop to that there's a side to them that I also want to go grab a pizza with them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And just like hang out.
Very charismatic dude. Very spiritually conscious.
Yeah.
Down to earth. Has a great sense of humor. Knows his shit.
Oh, and I want him to be my doctor. Is that bad? Like, I just want to go and like, yeah, I got a runny nose. Can I just hang out with you?
Yeah. Can I just come see you? Check it off on the insurance. That's fine. Whatever.
Right.
Well, I think he kind of liked us. He said he'd be willing to come back. Right. So.
That's rare too, you know, because like we can be over, I'm playing, but no, yeah.
And it's not like he's not busy. Like that was an hour and a half or hour and 15 minutes. You know what I mean? Like he's just like, no, I want to come back and talk with you guys and learn more about you, which what? Who says that on podcasts? You know, like.
That's what I love about Dr. P is that he's such a down to earth dude. Like he is very much like us, you know, he doesn't hold himself in some like high regard or anything, but at the same time, he's not diminishing his knowledge or anything. It's like a balance, right? He's like, hey, like he knows he's smart. He knows he has knowledge to share, but he's not cocky about it. He's very confident in and of himself, but also humble. Yeah. He's phenomenal. So what did we talk about in this? We talked about mainly the V word.
Yeah. And we answered, we asked some of the Telegrammer questions. So, mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, those were covered.
Yeah, I gotta let whose question did I answer?
Dude, his version of a virus was fantastic. I've never like the way it was lined up, the way he described how they're made by the body and like presented to the body. I thought it was fascinating.
You know, it's cool because it marries so well with like
Calvin
some of
Kaufman.
Our it does in a different way. It's a different angle, but it marries well. It's not like, whoa, that's really at odds with you know, and it's cool because all these approaches, that's another guy we need to get on as Dr. Kaufman, but like that all these approaches marry so well with each other in such an intuitive way. And how he describes viruses, just like you said, is just phenomenal. And intuitively it makes so much sense.
Yeah.
And then why we can't call this vaccine coming out a vaccine. I love that. Nobody's ever said that, right?
Yeah.
He said it.
I was like, oh my gosh, I'm now going to use that.
It's not a vaccine. Yeah.
No.
that's so good. And then the two questions at the end that TJ and I always ask, those were some of the best answers that we've had. Like it was phenomenal.
That's enough about that, man.
Yeah, well, that's enough talking about it though. Let's let the people listen. So let's go ahead and get an episode.
I'm pumped up. I'm pumped up, one, because we have a specialist of over however many years, because we don't count years. We're just flowing through time. But he is comes from my field. He's pediatric chiropractic, but he's also a pediatrician. He also is Jason Shirka's pediatrician, or was Jason Shirka's.
Was.
The web that Dr. Pilevsky connects us all to is pretty substantial. And Doc, I got to say, there's so many different ways I want to go, and we've got limited time. I have so many questions. I guess from this standpoint of, so I'm very much, as far as vaccines go, I don't know, just let's just keep it a choice. That's all. And let's let people find out as much information as they want and then make a really, really great informed decision. And the questions I get from a lot of people, not only just the schedule, how it's increased over the years and everything else, but the questions come back from, what about chickenpox? What about polio? Vaccines should be mandated because they were so successful with those diseases of old. What's your explanation or description of how have vaccines been affected historically to kind of where they are today, okay, regarding those?
Great. All right. So first of all, thank you for having me on the show.
Of course.
And I look forward to an excited, passionate discussion. I'm going to try and answer it from this perspective. The current thinking in vaccine science, and I use the word vaccine science carefully, like jumbo shrimp, because there is no real science with vaccines. There's consensus, but not real science. But be that as it may, the belief in our culture is that when you vaccinate against a germ, if you no longer see the illness from that germ, you believe that the vaccine has worked. And therefore, your answer is, we have a successful vaccine. And so here's one for example. We have been told that measles was eradicated from the United States in the year 2000, and now we're having a resurgence of it. But before 2000, when the vaccine was introduced in 1963, up until 2000, we eradicated the measles infection. And so the thinking is the vaccine made the disease disappear. And to go one step further, the consensus is that not only did the vaccine make the disease disappear, but it made the actual virus disappear. And there is 100% belief in the vaccine arena, pro-vaccine arena. And I heard experts say this in my testimony in Connecticut in February of 2020, in my testimony in South Dakota in March of 2020. The experts repeated this, infectious disease experts, neurologist experts, pediatric experts, public health experts. If we vaccinate a sufficient percentage of children, there will be a decreased amount of the germ to circulate in society. So the consensus is that by vaccinating, the measles virus or any of the other viruses and bacteria will no longer be able to circulate because the vaccine will make the germ disappear. Number one, no one has ever tested what happens to the measles virus after the vaccine is given. No one's actually done a full population study of kids. Do they still have the measles virus? It is just assumed that if they don't see the acute measles infection, the measles vaccine has made the virus disappear. And so we walk away and we say, look at us. We've done a great job. But there are follow-up questions. Number one, did the virus actually disintegrate? Because that's actually the main belief of almost all the pro-vaccine doctors. The virus is gone. Number two, is it possible that children are getting other acute illnesses that are measles infections, but we're calling them something else? Mm. And number three, this is the hardest one to grasp. Okay, so we don't see acute measles infections anymore. Are we now seeing chronic measles infections? Because we're taking the live measles virus and we're injecting it into the body. And we're saying that because we're injecting 95% or more of the children, we have made the measles virus disappear. That's why we don't see acute measles infections anymore. But we've never tested to see if the virus is still in society. We just assume it's not in society because we don't see the acute disease. But again, we may be calling it something else, or we may have shoved the measles virus deep into the body of the children vaccinated, now causing a chronic measles infection. So great, we don't see acute measles as much. But what about chronic measles? What about chronic mumps? What about chronic rubella? What about chronic varicella? No one has ever proven that the germ disappears. And anyone who says, well, we don't see the disease anymore, is either not doing research, not thinking, or not considering the possibility that another illness is now looking just like that old acute illness. We're just calling it something else. Mm. Or we've created something more chronic. How can you get the measles virus to disappear, not circulate in society anymore because you vaccinated a sufficient percentage of children, when you're taking the actual virus and putting it in the body? And so there's a wooden nickel slot machine here, because I don't know what's happened to the germs of all those quote unquote successful vaccines. And we refuse to acknowledge the possibility that after we've walked away thinking that we have gotten rid of the acute illness, we have created something worse in its place. And we have turned our heads away because we are so devoted to the idea of a vaccine making a disease go away that we worship it and we bow down to it and we drink the Kool-Aid of it, a la Jim Jones. And then we say, see? Look at all of this. We don't see the disease anymore, and completely ignore any of the ramifications of what getting rid of that illness actually means to the body, to the microbiome, and to the society. And so for things like pertussis, well, sure, now we're seeing mutations of the bacteria because we've been giving the vaccine. And so we are seeing other bacteria causing illnesses when we think that we're neutralizing like some of the Streptococcus pneumonia bacteria in the Prevnar vaccine or the PCV13. So we're always ricocheting. For every effect, there's an equal and for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. But we're ignoring anything but bad that may rise from the ashes of our honorable, sacred, devoted program. And so what I would say is, okay, well, we've landed a Scud missile on an entire city when we were just looking to bomb one building, and we walk away saying, I don't see a city being bombed. I'm just glad I got rid of the building. Hmm. And that's really what vaccines have done. And so the devotees, the worshipers, are not going to be able to access the parts of their psyche that can actually say, well, what have we done?
I love it. Man, thanks, Doc.
That analogy right there reminds me of our response to COVID-19, it's like very reductionist, right? Like, as long as we're doing this one thing, it doesn't matter what else we cause by doing that one thing, as long as this one thing is accomplished, right? Like, in this approach of eradicating a virus. I actually do have a question pertaining specifically to measles, interesting enough, since you just discussed that for a while. It comes from Elizabeth, who's in my Telegram channel. So measles, prior to the introduction of the vaccine, for most people, after contracting measles, it was an immune-boosting, growth-promoting illness that gave them immunity. To correct me if I'm wrong, it was they had... I'll let you answer that. What was the immune-boosting properties of measles?
So, again, I mean, a measles infection before we had the vaccine, and most of the childhood illnesses, measles, mumps, chicken pox, rubella, even the flu, are childhood illnesses for a reason. And if we entertain the literature from Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine, these are illnesses that help the children remove excess wastes that come from being in utero, having a combination of genetic material from two parents, so that they need to prune just what's their genetic material.
Interesting.
Having more of brain cells than they need when they're born. And so part of that fever illness helps to prune the nervous system, to prune the immune system. And there is some literature to show that the expression of a measles infection is actually in response to toxic exposures in real time. And that it's not a virus that necessarily is caught, but it's an expression of an internal virus in response to an accumulation of toxins and wastes. The Chinese and the Ayurvedics say it very clearly. It's an attempt by the body to remove fetal toxins. But even there's literature coming out of China, which shows that there were measles infections in places where there were higher levels of pollution in the air. And so we think, oh, it's just a virus, when we don't really understand that viruses are responsive to epigenetic forces. And so if you create toxins around you, and we're born with them, we're exposed to them through our genes, we're exposed to them in utero, we're exposed to them in the air, the food, the water, the skincare products, the emotions in our environment, the electromagnetic radiation, the air pollution, we're exposed to them. And so the viral expressions are merely responses to epigenetic forces that allow for pruning and cleaning, cleansing, and maturation of the developing immune system and nervous system of infants and children. And so when I was a medical student and a resident in the 1980s, it was very clear the pediatricians who had trained us during that time, who had been practicing pediatrics in New York since the 1940s, very easily said, we saw major growth spurts in the children in our practices and developmental growth spurts after they were allowed to have their childhood illnesses. And so it was right there in my teaching, and it's right there in the science if we understand where viruses are located in the body and what they are epigenetically triggered by to express the release or the removal or the discharge or the expelling of excess waste and inflammation in the body. It's very simple. That's why kids do better after the viral illness if it's not suppressed with over-the-counter medicines and pharmaceuticals, because they've cleansed. You know, it's like what does somebody feel like after they've done a primal screen? You've cleansed. You feel rejuvenated. So these viral illnesses, this measles, was often seen more damaging in areas with poor sanitation, poor health conditions, poor nutrition, poor water supplies, crowded living conditions. And in the mid-1940s and 50s, when the health authorities realized, oh, wow, if we clean up the sewage, if we bring clean water, if we improve living conditions, if we make more sewer systems, people actually stop dying from these illnesses. And so again, we have ignored in hundreds of years of Western medical practice the fact that the environmental toxicity is most often the cause, if not one of the major contributing factors, to the body needing to get sick, because you have to expel the toxins so that your body doesn't die until it's supposed to die. So I think I answered your question.
No, that was like better
fantastic
than the question that I'd formed. So thank you so much for that. That was perfect. I hope Elizabeth will be happy with that. That was her question.
Thanks, Elizabeth. All right.
The buddies just came swinging with the vaccine questions, but I want to step back a little bit. If I could ask you about just 2020. I feel like everywhere I've turned, I've seen your face. You know, you were with you did an awesome video with Jason Shurka. You did another video with Lori Lodz, and you do a beautiful job explaining things in a very simplistic, kind way. But how have you been handling the spotlight?
I'm not in the spotlight.
Yeah,
yes,
buddy.
You are.
Celebrity.
No.
You're not like Insta famous, but like people know who you are as a very credible source, you know? So
they're just messing with you, Doc. It's like they're saying that like people seek your knowledge because you provide such valuable information on these topics.
Okay. So thank you for saying that. But I want to say something very, very clear for the record. Mm-hmm. I'm not in this for me.
Yeah.
This is not this is not about me. I'm in this because I have been given a gift to hear, see, smell, taste truth. Mm-hmm. And I have been given the gift and the blessing to deliver it in a way that people can more palatably hear, taste, smell, and feel, and see.
Right. And because of that, I guess the question is, how have you been adapting to the attention that you've been receiving?
I'm not aware of any difference.
So you're not?
No, Joe, I'm not kidding. I have a lot of people around me with whom I never talk about this work.
I see.
And I also have people around me who keep me honest. And then I have my own internal spiritual practice, where I'm very quickly redirected if this becomes anything to do with me and my personality. Because it's not about me. It's about a larger truth. That's why when I deliver the information, I often tell people, this is not my opinion. I'm offering you information that I have experienced, researched, experimented with, intuited, learned, etc.
Agreed. But the reason why I ask that is in my community, right? So I'm in Newtown, Bucks County, Pennsylvania, as I told you before. And I used to be the guy who was the holistic wellness psychiatrist that was respected by my community. And then ever since I started speaking up on just basic science, you know, you start getting labeled as a quack, as a conspiracy guy, and people turn on you in a heartbeat, you know? So, and I know that for some of my other friends in the health freedom community, we gotten a lot of backlash from some of our friends even. So, I guess that's why I was curious, not from an ego standpoint, but just from like, just from the public eye, when you start getting your name out there, there are going to be some people that's going to want to say something about you and so on. And so different people have different ways of adapting to those kind of rumors or, you know, voices. So I was just wondering if that's come your way. Seems like you're not paying much attention to any of it.
I really don't read anything that people say about me, because this is not about me.
Yeah.
If you think that you have information that is important to share, share information. If you want to discuss it in an open public forum, discuss it in an open public forum. I'm happy to. But if you're going to resort to calling me names or saying things about me as a person, I have no interest in participating, mm-hmm. because you have nothing. because this isn't about me. This is about the work. And so bring the work. Bring the work. But if you can't bring the work, stay home. I'm not interested.
That's an awesome perspective too, because I know, so cool. And I always don't draw parallels between you and Dr. Cowan because you have so many similar things to say. I never mentioned to him, I forgot to mention him, the term viraling.
I've been using it.
Okay. That's awesome. But it's so interesting because he always says the same thing that if you're going to come at me, actually address my arguments and claims that I make rather than attacking me as a person. He keeps on saying, I have yet to see someone actually address the claims that I make. It's always attacking me as a person, whether it's right. An ad hominem, straw man, whatever. It's never actually addressing the argument.
And Correct.
So Doc, a lot of questions are coming up around specifically, and I've been dying to ask you directly about there's a field over here that viruses don't exist, they're exosomes. Then there's a field over here that viruses, in regards to what we're experiencing now, what we've been told is a specific virus causing the disease COVID-19. Some saying it doesn't exist, like the disease, because the virus hasn't been isolated, therefore there is no disease. It's only in a patent. I want to know, one, what your take on it is specifically, maybe viruses in general, just what your truth is, and then what we're experiencing now. And based on that, are there mutations? Because that's the next news coming down the line, or news in quotes.
Okay. So to answer a 3-hour question in a couple of minutes, that's really well done.
I'm sorry.
You threw me a curveball.
Right, from the left side.
From the left side, right. So I'm just going to share really what I was taught about viruses and what the research says about viruses. Mm-hmm. And the opinion about viruses that's in the mainstream is wrong. Because we are always made to believe that the only time you have a virus in your body is if someone is sick over here and transmit that virus to you. And then you have the virus. Otherwise, if you're not next to sick people, you have no viruses. And that's the simple, very basic belief. And that's why we vaccinate, right? We vaccinate against viruses because the belief is that you haven't gotten the virus yet because you haven't been sick and no one is sick with that virus has given it to you. So we're going to give you either a piece of that virus or the whole attenuated live virus, and we're going to inject it into your body and prime your body to mount an immune response against it. So that if you are somewhere in your life exposed to that virus, which again, only happens if you're exposed to someone who's sick with it, you will be protected because you will have a priori an exposure through a vaccine. So again, the assumption is that the virus is not in your body unless someone is sick and gives it to you. Period. Now that's so incorrect, right? Why is that incorrect? Because hundreds of thousands of genes or more that are inside our chromosomes make viruses. And we have not sat there in our brilliance and come to understand what all these viruses do. But next to the genes that code for our physical body, of which there are only about 20,000 of them, there are hundreds of thousands, or maybe more, right next to and embedded inside with our genes that make viruses. And so we are viraling, we are making viruses all the time. So what makes our genes transcribe into pieces of our body are external forces. Foods that we eat, thoughts that we have, medications we take, environmental stressors, you know, injections. The genes in our body are selectively turned on and turned off based on what's called epigenetic factors. Well, the same thing for viruses. And one of the roles that viruses play inside the cells is to regulate cell health. And one of the ways to regulate cell health is to get rid of wastes from the cell. And that's what your exosomes are. Your exosomes are attempts by the cell to take those virus-like particles and viruses and put them into pockets and extrude them from the cell so that the body removes the cellular wastes because the cells can't maintain them for any length of time. So we then have over 100 trillion bacteria lining our body, nose to lungs, mouth to anus, skin, and the reproductive system in women. Hundreds of trillions of bacteria. And viruses are embedded inside these bacteria as well.
Oh, wow.
And so the number of viruses and virus-like particles that circulate in our body at any given time is in the hundreds of trillions, potentially. But if you don't have the measles infection, you don't have the measles virus, because the only way to get the measles virus is if someone who has the measles gives it to you. And so we're also breathing in viruses all the time. So they replicate inside our cells, and we have trillions of cells. So you can imagine how many viruses we're replicating. We're not sick. We have trillions of bacteria, hundreds of trillions of bacteria, with viruses inside of them, because viruses are smaller than bacteria, and viruses can't be seen with the naked eye or under a microscope. They can only be seen in two-dimensional view under an electron microscope, and no one has ever watched a virus do anything because it's too small to actually watch a virus enter or exit the cell. And so those wonderful electron microscope pictures, they show the virus at the cell membrane. And everyone says, look, this is evidence of the virus going into the cell. Well, what about evidence of the virus going out of the cell? It's two-dimensional. How can you know it's just going in and not going out? So you have all these viruses in the body. And the thing is that they can't replicate themselves. Whereas bacteria can make more of itself, viruses can't. So they have to hook in to a genetic mechanism. The nucleus or the bacteria can do that. And, you know, I haven't talked about the mitochondria, but the mitochondria are the fuel cells of the body that are in every cell except red blood cells. We have thousands of mitochondria in cells. So then multiply cells by trillions. And so we can potentially not even count the number of viruses that are in our body. And they cannot replicate without a trigger from an external environmental factor that then is only going to replicate if it's embedded inside a genetic code. So in order to get sick from a virus, which is a millionth of an inch long, we're talking about something that is so small that we're creating as so deadly. You have to breathe in a virus. It has to get inside your cell through the cell membrane. It then has to get inside the nucleus, inside your chromosomal mechanism. And then it has to turn on. And it has to turn on enough to make you sick. So how many viruses do you need to be exposed to get sick? Well, we don't know. We just say, there's a virus going around. Well, there's always a virus going around. There's never not viruses going around. So then the question points to, if all these viruses are circulating in our body, in our cells, in our bacteria, we're breathing them in, and we're not sick, what's different about this thing that we're calling SARS-CoV-2? And no one has asked that question. What's different about this? And if you really study viral illnesses in the body, they are almost always an expression of outward movement of symptoms. They expel material out of the body. Mucus dripping down, cough production with gunk, viral syndrome, vomiting, diarrhea, rashes, right? Always an expelling of material. This illness is not a wet cough. This is a dry cough. And this illness is not an airway illness. It's a blood disorder. So how are we getting a coronavirus respiratory virus that's known to cause respiratory illnesses giving us a blood disorder? Now, in my training as a doctor, we were supposed to do what's called a differential diagnosis when we saw a presentation of symptoms. If a patient presents with a certain set of symptoms, dry cough, fever, body aches, fluctuation of blood pressure, loss of taste, loss of smell, tight diaphragm, hypoxia on pulse oximetry, adequate blood gases, so they're ventilating, they're giving off carbon dioxide, but their oxygen level is 50, and they have evidence of strokes in their body. Who in their right mind calls that a virus? Right? No one who's thinking clinically calls that a virus. They say, this isn't a respiratory illness, this is a blood disorder. What causes a blood disorder where you can ventilate but not oxygenate? Oh, okay. Hydrogen cyanide. Oh, that's interesting. Where would we get hydrogen cyanide? Did anybody test people to see if they were breathing in cyanide or if it was coming in any other way? No. Electromagnetic pulsing. Right? Electromagnetic pulsing can partially contribute to some of these symptoms. Right? Parasites. Why parasites? Well, why are people who are getting sick with this virus being treated so successfully with drugs that treat parasites? So there needs to be some degree of scientific discussion about the clinical presentation, which is not a respiratory illness. It becomes a respiratory illness because of the hypoxia and because of the cytokine storm. And because of potentially an autoimmune reaction and the clotting factors that are off based on some of the research that showed von Willebrand factor changes in different populations. And then you have this elephant sitting in the room of a dead horse on your lawn where Dr. Fauci's been participating in gain of function research on coronavirus, whereby he knows that coronavirus is a benign virus. And he's going to do gain of function research to make it more potent, virulent, infectious, or maybe fatal. And so we're saying it's the virus that's doing this, but this isn't the way viruses work. It just defies virology. And the interesting thing is that any of the doctors who are trying to speak up the truth, they're getting suppressed and censored. So it should make anybody go, why is that? Don't we want to have a good discussion about what's really going on clinically? And so when doctors were taking care of patients and saying, wait a second, ventilation is incorrect, putting these people on respirators is just wrong, and they were censored or they lost their jobs or they were placed in other parts of the hospital, and said, shut up, we're going to keep doing this. And then we dig under that rock, and that rock says, well, we make more money if we put them on a ventilator. even though ventilation was probably what killed a lot of patients. So you have to have a strong heart and an open mind to be able to sort of look at the differences of information and then think it through, for goodness sake. But, you know, there's never going to be a doctor who's going to go side by side with me and answer any of my questions, because it doesn't fit the narrative that we're being told to express. So
thank you. That was,
I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
And the nefarious piece of that too is that, like, people who are critically thinking about this have so effectively been labeled in people's minds for so many people as a conspiracy theorist or quack. So now the doctors who already would not want to be on the same stage as you having this discussion are able to just say, oh, well, that's why, because I would never entertain the views of a pseudoscientific quack conspiracy theorist.
I'm going to leave that to the psychiatrist to comment on. That's
great. Well, I do have a question though, and this is like a change of pace. I don't know if we want to get off of this. It has to do with, or Joe, do you want to go first? Do you want to?
Yeah, I was just going to say that 50 minutes went by and I asked one question, and we all, like, Tommy asked two and you asked one.
Go ahead. My bad. Go.
No.
Joe, above the ears, calm. Joe, it's okay.
You just have so many questions to ask. That's what it is. This happens every time. We have 18 more questions.
This is great.
Yes, this is so good.
It's so fantastic.
I know. Absorbing all this stuff, but Alec, your turn, please.
I'm satisfied.
Yeah, I'm sure you are.
Check this guy out.
I'm all right.
I want to hear Joe's question.
Joe, go, dude. Go. I got mine next.
I want to hear Joe's question. I really do. I mean that sincerely.
Well, I feel like I might have like one or two more questions. So let me just ask the one that everyone's been asking about, which is, do we know for sure, Doc, what are the known ingredients in this Sharona vaccine? Hmm. I refuse to call it COVID because my understanding is that we haven't.
That's a new word you have
Joe,
to use.
Joe's used,
you got to use Sharona.
He's used Sharona so much, though, he got the hashtag censored.
Oh, wow.
It did?
Yeah.
Oh,
wow. It's censored.
Oh, wow.
Sharona.
So I'm going to go in, Joe. I'm going to go deep in what you just said. I don't think you have a leg to stand on to call it a vaccine in the first place.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Nice.
So I want to start from there.
Yeah.
We cannot legitimately and scientifically call this a vaccine. That is absolutely wrong to call it a vaccine. Now, what is it? I don't know. What's in it? Some of the ingredients have been publicized. Others have been proprietary and kept hidden. And for those people who are devotees, they will read the package insert and say, see, they were transparent. I don't see anything wrong with these ingredients. They should be fine. And of course, that's a devoted, you know, response, not a critically thinking response. But I can't call this a vaccine. And the reason I can't call this a vaccine is because we have never utilized this technology in the history of vaccinations to attempt to prevent against disease. Right. And if you read some of the deeper material from the vaccine manufacturers, this is a treatment, not a vaccine. And the only way that something like this can go under the emergency use authorization is if science has shown that nothing in society has been effective in treating, curing, or preventing these symptoms. And that's why all the doctors who have been treating, curing, and preventing these symptoms have been censored. And these doctors have stopped people from dying. They have stopped people from being hospitalized. They have stopped people from getting severe illness. And the vaccine manufacturers have plainly shown that their quote unquote injection, not calling it a vaccine, is not meant and has not been tested to prevent death, prevent hospitalizations, prevent serious symptoms from this condition, or stop the transmission of the disease. So my question as a clinician is, then what does it do? I mean, why give it? If it doesn't stop death, because it never was tested to prevent death, stop hospitalizations, because it was never tested to prevent hospitalizations, stop transmission, because it was never tested to stop transmissions, stop severe development of severe symptoms from the disease, because it was never tested to stop the development of severe symptoms, then why give it? And what is it going to do? And that's where you go down the rabbit hole. And I prefer not to. I prefer to stay in the science discussion. But
yep.
It's not a vaccine. It's not been proven to be a vaccine.
So I've been told that there's plastic in there, that there's an ingredient called squalene that comes from a shark that causes transverse myelitis. Also, an aborted male lung fetal tissue. Have you heard about that?
Well, I mean, I don't want to conjecture. All right. I mean, there are certainly other vaccines in history where there's been squalene, where there's been aborted fetal cells, where there's been dust and iron and aluminum and mercury and lead and particles actually from the ground that were found to contaminate vaccines or purposely put in vaccines. I don't know either one. But again, not one ingredient in any of these injections has been tested appropriately for safety to be injected into humans. I mean, even polyethylene glycol, PEG, which is well known to cause anaphylactic reactions, is in there and acceptable. And, you know, I mean, some of the recommendations from the manufacturers and from hospitals is make sure you have a resuscitation kit nearby. I mean, the disease that we're dealing with, which may or may not be from a virus, is treatable. And they have not been able to prove that the injection of this material is going to give you a better outcome than if you actually were treated with the protocols that we've been seeing, or if you were given the protocols to prevent the development of the symptoms in the first place.
Right.
And that's what I mean by the devotees, the devotees. Mm-hmm. Oh, vaccine. It's not a vaccine.
Yeah.
It's not been proven to be a vaccine.
It's really interesting you say that, because Dr. David Martin, actually, I watched a little bit of something he was on today, and he said the exact same thing. And then there was another, forget who, 3 days ago said the exact same thing. So it's so cool hearing this from multiple people now that this cannot be classified as a vaccine. I believe Dr. David Martin called it a medical device. There's more to it, but that's basically what he says. And I think of like what you just said, the only way an emergency use authorization can ever be approved per the like governmental regulations, right, is if there's not anything else available that is preventing death. And I think of intravenous vitamin C, zinc, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, niacin, vitamin D, ozone therapy. The number of things that have been suppressed is truly unbelievable. My question to you is, how is it that doctors are being made aware of this, because the censorship is so outright at this point. It was previously like, oh, no one's getting censored. Then it turned into, oh, only some few people are getting censored. Then it turned into, okay, well, yeah, there's a lot of doctors and experts getting censored, but it's the social media companies are within their rights to do so. So it's like just been this slow progression, right? How can so many doctors see this happen and allow it to happen within their profession?
Okay, so I can't speak for those doctors. Mm-hmm. I can only speak from an observational perspective, all right? If you put every member of society on a ship, the doctors are going to be the last ones on the ship before it goes down. They're going to hold on till the last minute. Because most doctors, unless they practice non-insurance medicine, solo non-insurance medicine, successful solo non-insurance medicine, they are going to have a difficult time speaking up because the forces, the pressure to adopt the narrative are so infinitesimal that it could lead to potential loss of income, loss of societal standing, family having to move, ostracization, loss of license, loss of hospital privileges, and it just goes on and on and on. Mm-hmm. Loss of life, right? And so the system has brought doctors in so effectively that no one practices alone anymore. And so you have to speak the company voice, mm-hmm, or you're out. Insurance companies will drop you. Your colleagues will ask you to leave the practice. Your neighbors will shun you and your kids. You'll have to move to another neighborhood. It's like a red letter on your skin, you know, or a yellow star. So there, I mean, I remember years ago when I looked at a pediatrician 10 years after he trained me in third year medical school, and said, "Mike, are you really giving a hepatitis B vaccine to newborns who have no risk of getting hepatitis B infection in the newborn, toddler, or early childhood stages of their lives?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "But it makes no sense medically." He said, "Yeah, but I have to." And so that's not an uncommon response. "Yeah, well, that's what patients want. So yeah, I give them this, I give them that, I do this, I do that." The doctors are not autonomous beings. And the doctors who came from my generation or before, either too apathetic or retired or changed professions, because they saw that critical thinking, autonomous thought, real medicine that didn't involve protocols were no longer being welcome. And that forces like insurance companies and hospitals and corporations were telling them how much ink to use in the pen that they were using and how much paper they could have in their office. So we've lost the real flavor of medicine, where doctors actually were practicing clinical medicine. And now we're more in protocol and follow the bouncing ball and listen to the narrative. And, you know, I don't blame doctors for that unless they're willing to break out of the mold.
I think what kept you the way you are is the old lady telling you never forget you're always practicing.
Right.
Well, I think there were other things, but that was one of them.
Doc, this might be a stupid question. You said an increase in hydrogen cyanide. Where is that coming from all of a sudden more this year than others?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, there's certainly evidence that toxic wastes are removed in the air. The question is whether it was purposely put into the air.
Okay.
Or whether it was accidentally purposely put into the air,
right?
Or whether it was accidentally put into the air. And I'm not convinced yet that what it is that we're getting sick from is airborne.
Okay.
Like, I don't know if it's in the water, if it's in the food, or if it's in the waves, you know, the energetic waves.
Right.
I don't know. When you have somebody doing gain of function research on a coronavirus, and then you have an outbreak of so-called coronavirus infections, which isn't a respiratory illness, changing the definition of what a coronavirus does, then you have to ask, well, did they soup it up? And if they souped it up, what did they soup it up with? And that those clinical questions were not being asked. They're still not being asked at all.
Thank you.
Good doctor. So Kimberly Simonton, she's one of the our Health Freedom Vibe Tribers. She has this question. So she's saying, where is the 95% effective report coming from when it comes to this COVID vaccine?
This is good.
She's basically saying that she's read somewhere else before that at the time Moderna was at 64% in terms of blocking contraction of the virus. And now we're being told it's 95%. What do you think about the data?
Well, they're not data. I don't know what they are, but they're not data because they're not legit. In order to test effectiveness of what you consider to be a vaccine, the definition that we've been taught is, did the vaccine produce an antibody response? All right? That's not the way they deduced effectiveness in this trial. And certainly, of the 44,000 people that were in the trial, I think they based effectiveness on just 100 people who they tested through PCR testing. And so, knowing that PCR testing is inaccurate and not conclusive for the evidence of true virus versus viral debris, the only way to really test for test for effectiveness is to test for antibodies. And I don't believe that's been done. And then there's the term efficacy. So effectiveness is, did you produce an antibody? Now, we all know, I hope, that the development of an antibody does not equate to the development of immunity, even though consensus says, if you develop an antibody, you are immune. But we know that not everybody who gets a vaccine develops an antibody. And even if you do develop an antibody, not everyone who does develop that antibody has an antibody that is actually going to work to protect you. And so this is the flaw in vaccine science, that oxymoron.
I like the immune science, that we have a 99% recovery rate. I like those numbers a lot better.
In reference to what?
Our immune system has a 99% recovery rate. So
No. That doesn't get reported.
Yeah.
Right.
That doesn't get reported. Now let's be fair. The recovery rate in people above 75 is actually 94%. But the recovery rate for the majority of people from this illness is over 99%. Now, an efficacious vaccine is a vaccine that's been demonstrated to show that over time, you have seen a decrease in the expression of the disease after giving the vaccine for a certain period of time. Now, most vaccine studies go 8, 10, 15 years. We're basing this on 8, 10 months. So we cannot test for efficacy. And we've never looked at effectiveness, because the only way to test for effectiveness is through the development of an antibody. And if they're using the PCR as a marker for effectiveness, then they're doubly lying, because they're using a test that's not accurate, and then they're concluding something from that test. So they're creating two sets of lies. Yeah.
Alec knows all about that, the PCR test.
That's like my thing. That's like the thing that I harp on the most.
Oh, you've grabbed onto it, huh, Alex?
Well, I have a friend who, since the very beginning of the pandemic, and like in April and May, he runs three PCR labs in New York and New Jersey, and he's been providing me information consistently. That one of my last posts that I made prior to having that post removed for spreading harmful misinformation was a post breaking down PCR to like include a limit of detection, to include what viral medium it is carried in when it is like actually processed, everything. And multiple lab techs were commenting on it, saying how awesome it was. And again, it's not about me, it's about the information, right? The information was accurate, and multiple lab techs were commenting on how accurate it was. And then it was removed for spreading harmful misinformation. So
not to mention the fact that if the cycle threshold is above 35, there's a greater chance of contamination and debris and false positives going up. And not to mention the fact that the labs weren't reporting the cycle thresholds that they were using. And not to mention the fact that even if it is positive, we've not done a confirmatory test behind it to actually know whether it's a real finding. And we're not associating it with symptoms. And not to mention the fact that it's never been designed to diagnose an infection or disease. And not to mention the fact that it's only meant to be used in people who have symptoms, who are sick, and not relevant in people who are well. Because we have trillions of potential viruses that we're exhaling and spitting out in our saliva and pooping out in our stool at any given time. So just because you find the virus there doesn't mean you're sick or infectious. So we have just destroyed medicine and scientific method because of the things that we've adopted as truth, when really what they are is consensus. And all we can wait for is enough people who carry consensus to die out so that we can actually bring science back into the fray.
Yeah, I forget who said it, but there's a quote that I always like, that science has nothing whatsoever to do with consensus.
Correct.
And that's what we're seeing right now. I do have a question. So I have two questions in a row, and then TJ has one final question after that to wrap things up. So are you familiar with Dr. Pierre Corey?
Yes.
And ivermectin. What is your opinion of ivermectin and what went on with that situation? Him professing like, look, this works. And then he also alluded to so many other things that have worked and them not acknowledging. I know we kind of touched on it a little bit earlier, but.
Right. So he gave, Dr. Corey gave a presentation in front of the legislature in his state, basically saying, look, we have had success treating patients with this drug and with these approaches. And he was basically pleading as an intensive care physician for the legislature to acknowledge his work, the work of his colleagues. And we all know what happened in that respect, because again, the narrative cannot be people can get better without a vaccine. The powers that be will not allow a narrative to show. And so what you hear the lay people speaking as experts. Well, you see, the hydroxychloroquine doesn't work. The studies show they don't work. Did you read the study? No. Do you know how hydroxychloroquine works? No. Did you do any research on this disease? No. Do you understand why it works and it's been used in Africa as a prophylaxis for malaria and it's safe and it's been used for 70 years? No. How are you such an expert on what the news is telling you? Oh, because they said it. And so that's how we're getting to the expertise, because they say, therefore, we know. And so that's what happened. I mean, I think Dr. Corey, you know, sounded like a really good physician. I ran a pediatric intensive care unit. I know what it's like to take care of sick kids who are on ventilators. I worked in a neonatal ICU for 5 years after my residency. I know what it's like to take care of sick kids. I know the devotion that goes into making those kids and adults better. And he was trying to raise awareness about his success. And just like what happened to the frontline doctors who were personally attacked, and where experts in the lay community were so confident that they knew the literature better than the clinical experience of these doctors, he didn't go very far, did he?
It's unbelievable. It's like, it's true.
It's believable.
It's believable. It's believable, yes. Probably for you at this point, it's believable. Mm. But for me, as someone who is not a practicing physician, I like, it's like, oh my gosh, I'm seeing all these experts, right? Because the narrative was always, oh, no experts say that. And now we have so many experts speaking on these topics, and it's just like, oh, they're being ignored. But so the next question is the importance, why is medical freedom and bodily autonomy, why is that important to you?
We as individuals need to have the right to decide what we put into our body. And where does it stop if we're forced to put materials into our body by the state? Are we then told what air we could breathe? Are we told what foods we can buy and eat? Are we told what clothes we can put on our bodies? Where does the overreach of the state stop? And because the belief about vaccines is that everyone needs to do their part so that vaccinating a sufficient number of people will stop the transmission of the germ to others, we're going to allow the state to say it's okay to inject these materials into our bodies. When we start to realize that vaccines don't, won't, and have never been proven to stop you from carrying the germ, no matter how what percentage of people might be vaccinated, and that you won't stop being able to carry it or transmit it, then we will continue to go down the road of tyranny and totalitarianism and obeyance of the state and devotion to false prophets and false gods in the media and in the government and in the science, who all of whom are telling people one inaccurate statement after another. And so it's almost impossible to take in the idea that vaccines don't make the germ disappear from your body, and that just because you're vaccinated doesn't mean that you won't be able to transmit the germ to someone else. And the fact that this COVID-19 injection has not been proven to be a vaccine and has not been proven to stop the transmission of any of the germ, then how can we mandate it? And so I'm happy to report that more and more people who never knew that there was a concern around injections into the body have now become concerned about injections into the body. Mm-hmm. And we might all know the expression NIMBY, not in my backyard. You don't really care about it until it's in your backyard. And then when it's in your backyard, you go, what? And for those people who want to line up for this injection, by all means, you have that freedom, you have that right. But my choice not to get it will not affect your health or societal health at all.
Thank you. That was awesome.
Fantastic. All right.
I think that might have been the best answer we've gotten for that question, guys.
Yeah, that was a good one. So Dr. Belevsky, we end with these two questions, the one Alec just asked and then this one. This one, It was crafted with a little help from Lori Ladd. So buckle up.
Uh-oh.
Here we go. Yeah. So
is this in response to the talk that I did with her?
No, this she crafted this for all the for all of our guests.
For all guests. Yeah. So all guests have answered this question.
Okay.
And so moving forward, you're walking towards a door that opens up to the new earth, to where we're headed. When that door swings open, what do you see? What do you see us doing? How are we living? What do you envision when that door to the new earth swings open? What's the Dr. Pilevsky view of the new earth?
You never change the existing reality by fighting the current system. To change the system, build a new one to make the old one obsolete. So what I see walking through that door is a new system of life, a new system of medicine, a new system of science, a new system of health, of curing, of healing, of relationship, of consciousness, of interpersonal dynamics, one that's not based on maternalism or paternalism, that's based on sovereignty and autonomy. Now, I'm not looking through rose-colored glasses. That's where we're moving, regardless of whether we want to admit it or not. And so how we get there and who comes with us is nobody's understanding. And when it happens, I have no idea. But the bottom line is that's the direction we're moving. And we are, I believe, at a time and place where we are bringing much more light to shine on the darkness. And I have to say that the darkness is doing a damn good job of showing their cards for us to bring light to it. And our job is not necessarily to save those who want to go with the darkness. Our job is to walk to the light. And so we can, if we choose to, because the information is there, the consciousness is there, the light is there. It's just a matter of whether you want to build something new. I mean, I liken it to the fact that we don't have to go to their supermarket anymore. Let's build better markets so that we can actually bring people food that they really want. And so the totalitarianism, the authoritarianism, the search for answers from another authority in life versus a higher authority that's truly the information highway that's going to give us so much of our answers is really where we're headed. We are going to see the demise of false prophets, false gods, and false idols, and the worshiping of them. And it's just going to be a matter of time. How many people get hurt? Who dies? What structures die? What structures are built? That's the open floor plan. But I think what's waiting there is something unbelievably new. Again, when I've said we're not going to have paternalism, people have said, oh, good, we're going to have maternalism. I said, no, you can't say. I don't know what we're going to have. But I do believe it will be sovereign. I do believe it will be autonomous. I do believe it will be living more in nature's law. I do believe it will be more connected to higher consciousness, higher power, and direction from higher power. And I do believe we're going to build relationships in ways that we never have before and build structures that we've never seen before. So enjoy the ride, come along, and let's see what happens.
That was awesome too. You had two endings that were like, damn.
That was huge.
That was awesome.
Man, you nailed it.
Wow. Dr. P, oh, that was man. Great.
Thank you.
Dr. P, yeah, thank you so much for joining us for this. This was great.
That went by really fast, Doc. It felt like 15 minutes, man.
I know. It was good.
Oh, I guess we have to do this again.
It was, you got to do a round two. Yeah,
that's cool with us. This is good.
No, I'm happy to do this again.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
I mean, this is an opportunity for people to consider other viewpoints, but to still find their own.
Yeah.
Right? That's the autonomy. That's the sovereignty. And that's the critical thinking that we're trying to encourage. And, you know, we're going to have a different leadership.
Yep.
Yeah, I love that. Well, Dr. P, thank you for this. This was phenomenal. Gentlemen,
appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was great.
Got it. All right, Doc. Have a good night.